I'm here today with Mia Bloom, Professor of Security Studies at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. Mia's research focuses on women in terrorism, rape in war, the exploitation of children in conflict, and suicide terrorism. She has written two influential books, Dying to Kill, The Allure of Suicide Terror, and Bombshell, Women and Terrorism. Mia, thank you for speaking with me today in the Global Observatory. As your research shows, women carrying out acts of terrorism is not a new phenomenon. They have done so for decades. But their role is increasing, and more women are drawn to terrorism than ever before. Why is this?
Well, you're right. Women have been involved in terrorism since the 60s and 70s, especially in the secular groups in Europe, many of which were left-wing groups. And part of what they did was they provided both ideological leadership as well as leadership to the groups. So, for instance, in Germany, the Bader-Meinhof group was in part led by Ulrike Meinhof. What we have now is we have larger numbers of women's involvement, but not in any kind of leadership role. What we see instead are women on the front line that are largely used because it's expedient, because they can get through security checkpoints, because they're not expected, but they're not necessarily making those decisions. One of the examples that I document in my book, Bombshell, is how in the 2002 Dubrovka theater siege, while there were several Chechen black widows wearing suicide belts, they were not in control of the mechanism that detonated those suicide belts. So while the women may be used as, you know, in essence, the shells for bombs, they're not making the decisions, they're not writing the ideology, they're not performing a leadership role that in previous generations we occasionally saw women in these positions of power and influence.
You've researched and interviewed women in terrorism in dozens of countries, from women in the Provisional Irish Republican Army in Northern Ireland to female tigers in Sri Lanka and female suicide bombers in Iraq. Are there common motivators and mobilizers across regions, religions, and cultures that push women to getting involved in terrorism?
One of the things that I found, you know, looking at very different kinds of cases of women's involvement is that there wasn't one single thing, but there were several things that linked women across, let's say, the Middle East, Europe, South Asia. The best predictor of a woman's involvement in any kind of terrorist organization is the involvement of another male family member. And this is done not just because there might be some sort of family or social pressure for the women to get involved, but it's also an excellent vetting mechanism for the organization to ensure that the person who's being recruited isn't going to be an informant or work for the government or provide information and spy. And so one of the things I started to see, whether it was in Northern Ireland or in Chechnya or in other instances, was terrorism as part of the family business, that one member of the family would get involved and the sisters and the cousins and female members would also get involved. And of course, this varied in terms of the levels of coercion. So in some cases, the women would be married off to well-known jihadis, knowing full well they probably wouldn't survive, you know, 2 years. In other cases, the women are motivated themselves to participate, but, you know, not necessarily as suicide bombers. So this varied significantly. One of the other things that linked women's involvement was when there were instances of sexual violence perpetrated against the women. That was one way in which women either used involvement in terrorism as a kind of take back the night, where in checkpoints in Sri Lanka, if the Sinhalese army sexually abused Tamil women, the Tamil Tigers made it clear that those women were welcome to join the LTTE and their reputations would be completely absolved. We also see this in places like Iraq, where Samira Ahmed Jassim oversaw the rape of 80 women. And of those women, 32 were already successful suicide bombers by the time she was captured. So the fact is, we see sexual violence against women as a motivator, but also as a way of mobilizing men by making the claim that if they do not go to the region, whether it's on jihad or they don't go to help their sisters in Islam, women will be raped and they didn't step up. One of the things that I said in the book is that there are a few things: respect, relationship, rape, as well as women may be wanting to rehabilitate their reputations. And this is in a few other instances where their reputations might have been placed into question instances of the first five Palestinian suicide bombers that were extensively written about by Barbara Victor show that the women were trying to basically reinvent themselves by becoming suicide bombers. One woman had been accused of having a sexual relationship outside of marriage. In one instance, a woman's father had been accused of being a collaborator. In another case, a woman was incapable of having a child and her husband left her. So this was a source of great shame in the community. By becoming a member of a terrorist organization and then becoming a shahida or a martyr, they completely reinvent themselves and no one thinks of them in a negative way. Now they're only seen in a positive. So there are a few things, you know, and the same thing in Northern Ireland. Women were able to gain a lot of respect by becoming members of the Provisional IRA to a point. And in fact, one of the things that I wrote about in the book that most people don't realize that while Bobby Sands and nine other of his colleagues went on hunger strike in Northern Ireland, women also went on hunger strikes.
And just to follow up on that idea of women and terrorism as redeeming their reputation and sort of establishing themselves as important in the community, do you think that empowering women in positive leadership roles, such as in political and peace processes or conflict mediation, could also counter participation in terrorism by modeling an alternative path for strong identity and social change?
Having women in leadership positions is definitely a way of incentivizing and motivating young women to follow suit. And one of the things that we're seeing in certain conflicts is that when women become suicide bombers and by becoming a suicide bomber, they become more famous than they could have ever in their lives, young girls are looking towards them as a source of emulation and want to follow in their footsteps. So having positive role models would be very important in terms of, you know, the next generation. I don't know if having women in positions of leadership in which this is not the norm is necessarily going to be helpful in certain cultures in which this will be seen as Western involvement through women. It's important that if the women have these positions of leadership, then what they do is there's no footprint of Western countries, and especially the United States, that it become, let's say, part of civil society, a bottom-up approach where women's involvement isn't seen as a negative or that they're puppets of the West. It is interesting, you know, 2 days ago, the head of Hezbollah, Nasrallah, had come out with a statement saying women can participate as suicide bombers, but they can't run for election. So here you have an instance where women's participation is permitted in one capacity, but it's not necessarily going to lead to a political role.
And as more women engage in violence around the world, there are also children fighting in Somalia, Syria, Mali, and many other current conflicts, not only as soldiers, but as child terrorists and even suicide bombers. Based on your current research, how and why is this happening?
A lot of the groups turn to women when it becomes very difficult for men to infiltrate a target. So the terms we use, for instance, are as targets are hardened and it becomes increasingly difficult for men to cross borders or checkpoints, a lot of the groups become very flexible and start to look towards women as a wonderful source of recruitment. The same thing has been true of children, where it becomes more difficult in the conflict either to recruit men or to get men through hardened targets. Children become a natural operative. We have started a study to look at the effect of having to face children who are militarized or armed. What effect is that on soldiers? Does it increase the levels of PTSD? And the preliminary study has shown that it becomes much more difficult over the long term. If American or British or NATO soldiers are facing children, of course there's a hesitance to shoot because these are children, but at the same time, there isn't an existing standard operating procedure. How do you engage children? So it's really a murky area. It's on a case-by-case basis, and so it's been very difficult to fight children's involvement in any kind of violent extremist organization. I'm hesitant to use things like in the media, child terrorist or baby bomber or baby jihadi, in part because many of these children don't completely understand what they're getting involved in, and they really can't make the kinds of choices to become members of a terrorist organization that adults can make. And so part of it is we have to understand the roles of the community, or whether there are cultures of martyrdom that are either gently or not so gently pushing the children in that direction, whether the terrorist organizations have youth movements in order to funnel children into the terrorist group, or whether there are cultures of martyrdom that actually promote involvement in terrorism or in jihadi operations. And all of these will have an influence on children to participate. And it's one of the things that's very worrying, because we're seeing increasing numbers of children. We're seeing children in Somalia being used in al-Shabaab recruitment videos. We see children increasingly in militant groups. And then also television programming and books and media directed at children in order to get them involved at an early age. And as we see this, we need to figure out ways to combat it.
And to end on a positive note, how can women and children be demotivated and demobilized? Have you encountered effective strategies or programs in the field for prevention and rehabilitation?
Perhaps one of the most effective programs I've encountered has been in the Swat Valley in Pakistan, an organization called Sabaun, which is translated as the first rays of dawn's light. And basically, this is a rehabilitation facility for children who have been caught by the military and the police involved in terrorism. In most of the cases, over 56% of the time, the children were coerced or kidnapped by the terrorist group or handed over by the families, also under duress, to the TTP, to the Pakistani Taliban. And it's important that this organization has retraining. It provides the children with education and skill set. It also provides the children with a religious studies as well, to undermine the existing stereotypes and falsehoods that the children have been taught by the terrorist group about the Islamic faith. So that is one of the better ones. I think what makes it so excellent is a multi-pronged approach. It's run by psychiatrists and psychologists and social workers. It's funded by the military, and the military has a presence there, but it's really run by people who are interested in the children, but also has a lot of aftercare that they're engaged in. So the follow-up visits, visits with the families and the communities to help with reintegration, that makes it unique. In terms of being hopeful, I think the idea is it's important to demotivate the children by providing them other opportunities and other pathways. If you have environments in which there is rampant hopelessness, a lack of education, no resources, the terrorist groups are offering something that may seem very positive to a child: food, shelter, protection for their family. If there are other opportunities, it's likely the children will choose the other opportunities. But in an environment in which there is nothing except the terrorist organization, it makes it especially difficult. And then it's important that we demobilize and we show terrorism, not just demobilizing at the individual level, but it's important that we demystify in what involvement in terrorism actually entails. I think the problem is, in many instances, both children and youth look at involvement in terrorism as something that's exciting, something that's a positive, and that if they actually knew what involvement really entailed, they'd probably be less enthusiastic. And so it's one of the reasons that I talk about this, in order to show that the terrorist groups, especially the transnational terrorist groups, really do not care about the civilians in that conflict. They are using the civilians for their own purposes. This is very different from ethno-nationalist conflicts, where the groups represent, let's say, a minority population. But with transnational groups, they're basically using the local population as cannon fodder. And if we can make that known, that will lessen their attractiveness to the locals and maybe inoculate the locals to have these terrorist groups operate from within their midst.
Mia Bloom, thank you for sharing your interesting work with us in the Global Observatory today.